This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross.
Ever notice how you come across somebody once in a while that you shouldn't have with? That's me.
That's Clint Eastwood playing a tough guy again in his new movie Gran Torino, which he also directed. This time, the tough guy is named Walt Kowalski, a grumpy old widower living in an increasingly run-down neighborhood in Detroit. He has a mint-condition 1972 Gran Torino in his garage. That's where the film gets its title. But nothing else in the movie is anywhere near mint. Not Detroit, and certainly not Walt, who is approached at the local bar by a young priest, played by Christopher Carley. The priest informs Walt that Walt's wife, before her death, wanted the priest to reach out to Walt. The suggestion doesn't go down well.
What do you want?
I promised your wife I'd get you to go to confession.
Now, why would you do that?
She was very insistent. She made me.
Well, you're kind of fond of promising things you can't deliver on, right, Father?
Let's talk about something else.
What?
Life and death.
Life and death. The hell do you know about life and death?
I'd like to think I know a lot. I'm a priest.
Yeah, you get up and preach about life and death, but all you know is what you learned in priest school. Right out of the rookie preacher's handbook.
I don't know about that. I think...
Death is bittersweet. Sort of bitter in its pain, but sweet in its salvation. That's what you know about life and death, and it's pathetic.
What do you know, Mr. Kowalski?
I know a lot. I've lived for almost 3 years in Korea with his bikes. We shot men, stabbed them with bayonets, hacked 17-year-olds to death with shovels. Stuff I'll remember till the day I die. Horrible things. But things I'll live with.
New York Times film critic Manola Dargis, writing about Gran Torino and Clint Eastwood's prolific and impressive film output, said, quote, "I'm not sure how he does it, but I don't want him to stop. Not because every film is great, though damn many are, but because even the misfires show an urgent engagement with the tougher, messier, bigger questions of American life," unquote. Clint Eastwood spoke with Terry Gross earlier this year when his film Changeling was released. At the time, she also asked him to describe his role in Gran Torino, playing a guy who, as the film begins, doesn't much like anybody, including his Asian neighbors.
Well, he's not anti-Asian. He's anti-everything. He's a guy who was in the Korean War. It's present day, a guy who was in the Korean War. But then after that, he went to work in the Ford factory for over 50 years, and he's now an older guy, and he lives by himself, and his neighborhood has changed, and the world is changing around him, and he's having a rough time communicating with his own family. And it's sort of how he befriends these Asian people who he at first doesn't like, just for the principle of it. The neighborhood's changed a lot, but then he forms a relationship with these people, and the story goes on from there.
Now, you were drafted during the Korean War. Do I have that right?
That's true.
And you were in a military plane crash?
I was actually drafted in the Army, but I was hitchhiking in a Navy plane, and they lost the plane in the ocean by Drake's Bay in Northern California. So I was supposed to stand by for a hearing.
A hearing investigating what happened?
Yeah, so the Navy asked if I'd stand by for a hearing on the circumstances. And so what happened is the Army, of course, said, sure, we'll keep him standing by for a hearing. Well, to make a long story short, the hearing never came, and so... I'm sitting there waiting, and all of a sudden, my 2 years are up, and then the hearing never happened.
Were you glad that you weren't sent to Korea?
Oh, yeah. I don't think anybody was really too happy to go over there. Korea was a rough war. It's kind of, a lot of people call it the forgotten war now. Very hot in the summer and very cold in the winter, and I don't think anybody that I knew volunteered for it, but most of my company did go. The irony of this mythical hearing is the only reason I didn't go.
How did you survive the plane crash?
We just got out, and we were close, you know, offshore, so we had to deal with rough weather, and it was in November. The pilot And I tried to stick together, but it didn't work out too well because he was, we got in and he thought I was dead and I thought he was dead. So I hiked south and he hiked north. And he came across a farm and the Coast Guard picked him up out there on the farm. And the Coast Guard then came and got me. I was at a RCA relay station up on the, in Marin County there.
So not to make light of it, but that was like your first big stunt.
Yeah, it was an interesting stunt. It was something you wouldn't want to do now. It's a you know, it's interesting. Drake's Bay, all that area, is been noted for being a white shark breeding ground. I didn't know that at the time, or else I probably would have had apoplexy and just passed out and probably wouldn't be here today.
My guest is Clint Eastwood. Of course, one of the series of movies that you're very famous for is Dirty Harry. And a Dirty Harry box set recently came out with all the Dirty Harry movies and a lot of extras and documentaries. Let's just start here with a mix of some of the most famous lines from your Dirty Harry films.
I know what you're thinking, Punk. You're thinking, did he fire 6 shots or only 5? Now, to tell you the truth, I forgot myself in all this excitement. But being this is a .44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and will blow your head clean off, you could ask yourself a question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk? Go ahead. Make my day.
You're a killer, Harry. A maniac.
Man's got to know his limitations.
Clint Eastwood, when you read those lines for the first time, did you think these lines will live in film history?
Well, I thought they had potential. The first one is from Dirty Harry, the original Dirty Harry. And when I first read the script by Harry Julian Fink, he had that little speech in there. But I also chose to reprise it at the end, too, because I felt it was such a good line. I felt it was a good way to wrap up the movie.
What were your first impressions when you read Dirty Harry the first time?
I just thought it was actually Paul Newman had led me onto it. He told Jennings Lang, who was an executive at Universal at that time, that there's a script that I read, this exciting detective story. It might be great for Clint. And, of course, when Jennings told me that, I said, well, how come Paul didn't want to do it? He says, well, he's got some questions about the political ramifications or what have you, but he thinks it's an exciting story, and you might want to do it. And I read it, and I did. I thought it was an exciting detective story and wanted to do it. I don't care much about political ramifications one way or the other. You know, you have to tell some points of view in different movies, so why not?
I think the political ramifications that Paul Newman would have been concerned about would include that Harry doesn't believe in Mirandizing people. I mean, because it just gets in the way. In fact,
true.
let's play a clip of that.
You're lucky I'm not indicting you for assault with intent to commit murder.
What?
Where the hell does it say you've got a right to kick down doors, torture suspects, deny medical attention and legal counsel? Where have you been? Does Escobedo ring a bell? Miranda? I mean, you must have heard of the Fourth Amendment. What I'm saying is that man had rights.
Well, I'm all broken up about that man's rights.
Harry doesn't have a lot of respect for the mayor. Dirty Harry, was your payback for that becoming a mayor and having to oversee a bureaucracy and oversee a police department?
Well, it was no. That was strictly a local deal in my community that I live, and I enjoyed that very much. But the question of whether it's payback of Dirty Harry, I can't say that because Dirty Harry is just a character. I don't really believe like that person. In fact, it's much more fun to play a person that you don't necessarily agree with in a lot of ways. But it's a fantasy thing. It's a fantasy. And wouldn't it be great if there was somebody like this? If I was in trouble in society, or if you were, or any one of us out there was in trouble, wouldn't you like to have somebody as dogmatic as this coming out trying to work on your behalf?
In your films, the Dirty Harry films, the Westerns, you've had to give and take a lot of physical abuse. What did you have to learn to do in order to take physical abuse within your roles?
Well, you get nicks and scrapes and bruises and things like that from whenever you do stunts, but you kind of live with it because you're into the roles. In fact, I always wanted to do all the stunts and stuff when I was a young man doing those things because it was all part of the character. But then as you get older and wiser, you decide, well, maybe you shouldn't jeopardize the production by putting yourself at risk and putting the whole production at risk by not having a stunt double.
What's the least wise stunt that you did in your career?
I remember having to be on the hood of a car. The scene is he's going to roll off the car just before the car piles into the bay. Well, they had me wired under the car so I wouldn't roll off and get hurt along the way, so they had a cable up drilled through the hood, and so I was wired onto the car. Well, all of a sudden, when you get wired on there with this cable, and you think, well, what happens if they don't stop in time? And you go right into the bay. I'm stuck wired on there. I can't even float to the surface. So it was, you know, a couple of things like that. They cause you to get a little bit of you get a little reticent, but in the meantime, I've had quite a few of them jumping through windows and jumping off roofs and things like that.
What's the like the worst real injury that you got from a fight or a stunt scene?
I think the worst one is I had a dislocated shoulder, but it wasn't from the stunt itself. It was I was riding a horse through a field of ice, and the horse feet went through the ice and it did a roll, and I went off through, and I landed in some rocks and stuff, and I had a dislocated shoulder. It was the last shot of the day, and it was the right time to be the last shot of the day. But the bad part was I had to sit in a pickup truck and ride for about an hour and a half to get to the hospital to get it put back in. So that was a long ride.
I'll
but
bet.
Then the movie went on because I just did everything left-handed for a few weeks until things kind of healed up.
Which movie was that?
That was in Pale Rider.
Clint Eastwood speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview from earlier this year with actor-director Clint Eastwood. His newest film, Gran Torino, opens today.
I want to ask you about some firsts in your life. You love music. You play piano. You write some of your own movie music. What was the first record that you remember buying?
Boy, that goes back a while. I think it was my mother bought some Fats Waller records, which kind of turned me on to sort of traditional jazz music and sort of stride piano playing. And then I started liking Wally Rose, Ralph Sutton, people like that. Then I started getting into bebop in the mid-40s, and that was then they went from more of Bud Powell, Thelonious Monk kind of thing. So as you sort of advanced along with it, music sort of became more bizarre.
You've made a lot of Westerns. What was the first time you rode a horse?
Well, I rode a horse when I was young. When I was a kid, I rode out when I lived with my grandmother. My cousins had horses, and so I rode frequently. Then when I got to, in the early 50s, I was a contract player at Universal Pictures, and as a contract player, you could go out on the back lot in those days and check out a horse and go riding, and I did that quite often. And so I got fairly proficient at it. So when I did get into a Western on a regular basis, like Rawhide was in the late 50s, I had some fairly good chops.
So when you were making Rawhide, did you have a good relationship with your horse?
Well, I didn't date him or anything.
No.
You know, it was a... it was a good relationship. I mean, the horse is a 1,000 pounds or more, maybe 1,200 pounds of animal that is has got the brain about the size of a walnut. So you always have to be very, very careful with horses and realize that they're only going to be contribute so much to the ride.
I've probably told you this before, but I was such a big fan of Rawhide when I was a kid. I know it was probably a very frustrating experience for you, but I love the show. And one of the things you had to do is learn how to, as the theme song goes, rope roll and brand them, because it was all about, you know, a cattle driving herd. So did you have to learn how to, you know, rope roll and brand steer?
Well, I did it periodically. Most of the time it was done by trickery. You know, you'd come in and you'd catch the steer, and then you'd cut to some other thing, and then come back and the steer was already branded or something. But it was great fun. That series was a great way to have a chance to be acting every single day and on a regular basis, where you can really kind of find out what your characteristics are.
How would you describe your character of Rowdy Yates on Rawhide?
Sort of an imbecile of the plains. He was kind of, I used to call him a trail flunky. We had a lot of fun making him, and he was sort of the impetuous youth.
Right.
So I was, and I have no regrets. It was a great learning ground.
Do you remember the first time you put on the poncho and chewed on a cigar stub for a fistful of dollars?
Yeah, very well. Very well. In fact, I'd gone to first time I did it was in Italy. I was on my way to Spain, but we did a couple scenes from it, and it was another character for me, another character away from being the trail flunky.
Did you go shopping for ponchos, or did a costume director just give you the
right
one?
I did. I took ponchos and stuff with me when I went over there, but we ended up picking up one in Spain that is the one that we end up using. But most of the wardrobe I brought with me, and I even brought the cigars with me. And the cigars were a very, very long, thin cigar called Virginia, and they're very, very powerful, unappetizing. And they put you in a terribly foul mood, so it worked for my character. They were great because I could chop them up in threes and put them in the pocket and stuff like that, and smoke them at different lengths.
Mm-hmm. Did you smoke for real at the time?
No, I've never smoked for mm-hmm. real. I've smoked in films and stuff. I mean, I can smoke, but I never got a charge out of it. I never felt any addiction for it.
Because you became a star on Rawhide, you did what a lot of stars at the time did. You made some pop recordings. And since we're talking about firsts, I thought we could talk about the first recording that you ever made. And I believe that was Unknown Girl?
Yeah, I think I did something like that, yeah.
Let's hear the first recording that you made. And this was a single called Unknown Girl in 1961. And here's how it sounded. This isn't the best recording of it, but it's the only one we have.
I would travel far and wide just to have you by my side. Unknown girl of my dreams. Take your hand.
That's Clint Eastwood recorded in 1961. One of the things I find so interesting about that is, you know, here you are, this guy who, like, loves Fats Waller and then decides, no, I also love Charlie Parker and Bud Powell. And here you are making this, you know, kind of very generically produced pop recording.
Thank you for not playing the whole record.
You're welcome.
I have to give you
You're welcome.
A lot of points on that one. But, yeah, well, you know, you're just, that's what music was all about in the 60s. You know, everything was... We're starting to get into the rock and roll era, and it wasn't complicated. But to have to listen, you think looking at yourself on the screen is tough. That is really tough.
There's nothing wrong with your voice. It's the arrangement that's so generic sounding.
I know the arrangements are really corny.
Well, Clint Eastwood, thank you so much for talking with us. A pleasure to talk with you.
Terry, good talking to you again.
Clint Eastwood, speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. His latest movie, Gran Torino, featuring him as both director and star, opens today. Here's Stride piano player Ralph Sutton, to whom Eastwood had referred earlier. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.